So one of the things that what was happening was the parks had gone through a long period of decline. They hadn't just hadn't been kept up, and they were in really terrible shape with graffiti and broken cobblestones, and they hadn't been the maintenance of all of the shrubbery and everything was terrible. It was abysmal looking. Central Park was terrible looking. So they started bringing Central Park back one little project at a time. And the first projects as they came forward, it was really problematic because they were trying to bring back, like the subway station, a kind of modernized version of Central Park that somewhat recognized the genius of the original design, but only somewhat. And so this stuff was just so awful. It was so unsympathetic to the character of what we now see in Central Park, which is the Olmsted and Vaux design brought back. Somewhere in this process, the mayor and the chairman of Parks under Mayor Koch was Gordon Davis, who was absolutely brilliant and who was a very savvy political operator because he'd been in very high positions in previous administrations. So there was a problem in bringing all this back, and it was that the designers who were working for the Parks Department bureaucracy were so incapable. They were producing these terrible designs. But they had tenure, they had sinecures. Gordon Davis couldn't just go in there and fire all of them. And he also couldn't open a design school for them to get them to be better designers. So for a period of time, probably a number of years, we kept on seeing these awful designs, and we'd criticize them, and they'd go back and be revised, and come back in again, revised again. What was happening was there was some kind of understanding between Gordon Davis and Kent that the design criticism of the Landmarks Commission was a productive thing. So sometimes on these matters, Kent wouldn't bring us to a vote. He'd have us discuss a playground, and it would be clear that we all felt very negatively about it. He'd list some of the negative things, the reason why we might make a negative finding, and then he'd say, let me call the Parks Department and see whether they would rather have a negative report or whether they'd rather revise the design and come back in later. And sometimes that's what they would do. We wouldn't have to issue the negative report because Kent would just make a phone call. But sometimes they would ask for the negative report. So the person at the Parks Department who was responsible for capital projects was a guy by the name of Bronson Bigger, who the Preservation Archive has probably interviewed at one point or another because he was so instrumental in the early years of the Landmarks Commission, the founding of the Landmarks Commission. So Bronson was very sympathetic. And he knew his design department was that good. And he would actively work with us to get the designs to be better. Then Gordon Davis figured out that because the city would never come up with a lot of funding for this, he needed a separate city organization to raise money for Central Park, which was the Central Park Conservancy. And that was created by Gordon and by the mayor. It was brilliant in two ways. One was that it obviously became so successful in terms of raising money, but it was also doing something else that was quite different. And that was partly Gordon Davis and partly Betsy Barlow, who was the first head of the Conservancy. They, between them, got a clear understanding that the path for the future of Central Park for its renovation was to bring back the Olmsted design. And you'd have to change some of the detailing because of modern functionality, but to bring it back. And so that suddenly meant that all of these little projects wouldn't be separate little odd things that would be poured into the pot of the park and make a kind of strange combination of projects. So as you walk through the park, it meant that everything would be brought back in harmony with the central idea, and so the park would become an artistic whole again. So when the Conservancy first started sending projects in, those of us who were on the commission recognized, well, this is much better work. The detailing of benches was better, the paving, the treatment to trees, every little detail of the project was so much better. Also, it was going, really, it was an avid search for what the Olmsted and Vork solution was. And even when they couldn't get to the particular bench that would have been in this section of the park, they would bring forward examples of 7 different benches by Olmsted and Vork that were all great, and lampposts and everything. So we started approving those things. And then what happened was Bronson Binger started accepting the work of the Central Park Conservancy as the standard for the Parks Department work, too. It was coming out of the bureaucracy. And so something must have happened inside his design department, because he got more talent in there. Mm-hmm. And what began to happen was we started seeing more and more designs that were going to bring Central Park, from both the Central Park Conservancy and the Parks Department, that were bringing Central Park, all focused on the same mission, which is to bring Central Park back as it was under Olmsted and Vork. So, but all of this unfolded in part because there was this wonderful relationship between Kent and Gordon Davis, which allowed for a critical, an intellectually critical and aesthetically critical dialogue that to occur between the two agencies. Sometimes this even occurred with the Central Park Conservancy. They would bring in a design, and normally their designs would be impeccable, but once in a while they'd bring in something that was kind of clunky. We would criticize it. Afterwards, almost invariably, we'd find out their funder wanted that one clunky thing, and when we criticized it, it became the basis for their not doing the clunky solution. So this became was a very productive relationship, and as you can see, was a non-adversarial one. Okay, that changed when Gene became chairman. That became a big issue for me because I got involved in the fight over Bryant Park. But it was a general change, and I think it had something to do with the mayor going on to his second and third term, with the fact that mayoralties that go on like that tend to become more rigid. They don't have the same openness as the first term. And also the people who are serving in the center in the mayor's office often are more are skilled as political operatives. And they can make a lot of things happen smoothly, but they may not be as sensitive in terms of the larger planning of the city. So that's what I think happened. In any case, what happened on the ground at the commission was we started receiving a bit more pressure from the mayor's office in regard to certain rulings. But it was pressure that wasn't directed to the commission as a whole. It was directed more to me. And I think Elliot found a bit of it, but I don't think the other commissioners did. They didn't know. Because the reality of the commission, I think at almost any point in time, is if a chairman walks into a room on an issue and has an extremely strong position that where they're advocating with their full emotion an approval or a disapproval on a matter, that a commission is generally reluctant to oppose a chairman when they mm-hmm. send out those kinds of messages. But that wasn't the case with me. I always wanted to talk about the merits. And that made it harder for on matters like this to just have them move in one direction or another. And as a result, I guess the people at City Hall began to see that I was the difficulty. And so I started getting messages that were sent to me from the chairman there's a deputy mayor at City Hall who wonders, are you aware you're up for reappointment? I'd say, well, why am I being reminded of that fact right now? And they'd say, well, it may have something to do with we ruled on this and this matter. It was in the paper the day before. So I started receiving messages like that. And it wasn't a lot of them, but it was enough to know that the mayor's office cared about some of these things. The reason why I gave you the example of Central Park is because obviously one of the event that caused everything to kind of explode or implode was Bryant Park, which was a public park situation. But Gordon Davis was no longer the head of the Parks Department, and Kent Barmick wasn't the head of the Landmarks Commission. And the new head of the Parks Department hadn't established the same kind of working relationship with Gene. And I think also what was going on was that there just wasn't the same openness, and the tone of the mayoralty was different. There was more of a sense of cooperation in the initial mayoralty, and less of it going on, I think, in this. So one of the things that was occurring was Gene, who may have not as been as comfortable as Kent was in dealing with these kinds of insider politics, would have us more frequently move to a vote on reports, which made them a little bit more confrontational, rather than stop the process and go behind closed doors and talk it through with the head of the other agency before issuing a negative report. And I remember talking to him about it at the time and saying, you know, Kent used to do it this way because it saved us from getting into an adversarial condition. Gene just said, I feel less comfortable with it. I'd rather we just make a ruling. But you'll have to check with him. That's my memory of this. So when we got to Bryant Park, we knew we were ruling on something where the mayor's office was involved, because they had helped, they had approved the creation of the Bryant Park Conservancy, and there had been an act of a legislative act in at the state level to de-alienate the property, is make it, in fact, make part of the park no longer public parkland, so that you could lease some of the ground out to for private profit to a private restaurateur for the restaurant. So that took a state action, but that would never have occurred without the support of the mayor's office. So there was a substantial commitment to making that project go forward before we ruled on it, and Gene didn't have the same relationship with the Parks Commissioner. And so what happened in the debate was we moved towards it. We knew we were, because Gene wasn't going to bring it as bring it forward conversationally. We knew we were moving to a condition where we either voted for it or voted against, and it was, and all of the adversarial stakes had all been raised. But again, part of this is not Gene, it's the change in the temperament and the tonality of the mayoralty. So part of it is Gene and part of it is that change. But that's one of the big differences. And it just made it tenser, I guess, in that part of the second part of my term, because there would be these issues in which I knew I was getting into a confrontational condition with the mayor's office, doesn't add to comfort, that's all.
Could you maybe sum up by speaking to Kent and Norman's individual legacies at LPC, if you could judge them looking back today?
I think it's always important to get a certain amount designated, get the maximum amount designated. Because the sooner things are designated, the less they're vulnerable to unfortunate circumstances that end up cause their destruction. So I think we're grateful to all of the early chairs who were able to get large amounts of material designated. And Gene didn't do that. So that in terms of regulation, Kent was open to increasing the quality of the, making the design regulation process more effective and having higher standards. Gene was less open to it, and this I think speaks to his excellence as a chair. He was less open to it upon first consideration, but was so willing to listen to other people that by the end of his term, he had embraced a much higher degree of regulation than existed when Kent was chair. It was able to occur under his commission. So I think those are the two big differences. Kent, meanwhile, then set into action five other great things, like the creation of the survey and all kinds of things. things. I mean, he was just a remarkable chairperson for the city to have. But Gene was a very substantial chairperson for the city to have. The question become that I think is obviously a question that should be examined is the question of designations and why Gene didn't create as many designations in his term as Kent did, with basically not just the same amount of staff power, but more. And in here, the whole story of the relationship of the advocacy groups and how they affect the performance of the commission comes into play. So once Gene had been in office for a year or so, it became clear that the designation process had slowed very dramatically. So it had gone from probably the average amount designated per year by chairman previous to Gene is somewhere around 800 properties per year, right? And Gene was designating, when you look at his first 4 years, 80 properties per year. So it was 1/10 of what the average was. And as a commissioner, I took a year to realize this was happening. It takes a certain amount of time. The new chairperson comes in, they have to settle in, you can't tell. And so this began to emerge that this was happening. And I didn't understand it, why we were designating so much less. Eventually, I had an experience that led me to understand that this was as a result of Gene's slowing down the designation process. And what happened was the head of the research department called me in to speak with, after a hearing one night, said, would you come downstairs and talk with the research staff? And I was surprised. And I said, sure. And I went down, and I don't know if her full staff was there, but a substantial number of people from the research staff were there. And they started explaining to me how upset they were that they weren't being allowed to write designation reports, and that we weren't designating things. Well, people were so upset that some of them were on the verge of tears talking about this. Wow. So from out of that experience, I came to understand that Gene just wasn't letting them designate. He was stopping them. This began to be an issue in our executive discussions because I started pushing at it. And other commissioners could see it was happening. And there was never really a very good answer for why. Although I didn't reveal to the other commissioners my meeting with the staff. I never revealed that to any of them because I thought that was a private thing. Eventually, we had some executive discussions, and Gene capitulated on the issue. And unfortunately, it was near the end of his tenure. And what was left, what really changes the numbers on in terms of designation performance is designating historic districts, because there's so many buildings involved mm-hmm. in one designation. So what it slowed down was the virtual elimination of the designation of historic districts. So the staff then began to work to put together designation reports for some big designations for the Upper West Side Historic District. Now, I believe the Upper West Side Historic District designation occurs under David Todd's tenure as chairman, but a substantial amount of the research occurred during Gene's time. But Gene didn't see the benefit of that in terms of his numerical record as chair, because he wasn't able to complete it during his tenure. So I think this all inverted. But one of the things that came out of this was we were having a retreat. The Landmarks Commission was having a retreat that I guess organizations have at various times so that people at executive levels can talk with one another. And when we were going up for the retreat, I called Gene and a week ahead of time, and I said, I want to discuss this designation issue. And he said, I know you're doing it. And I said, I want to have some idea of the designation history of the commission. And so I need the staff to help me to put together a record of the designation history, which had never been done before. So it was surprisingly a simple thing to do. In like 2 days, we got a list of, because we had executive reports, we got a list of what had been designated in under each, basically in every year. And so we had an idea of the rate of designation for the commission as a whole. And what came out of it, there were two things that came out of it. One was the general statistics of this, which after that retreat, I started speaking in public. Several times, I guess, in various executive discussions, I would raise these statistics. And one of the people who heard it was Christabel Goff. And she came up to me after one of the meetings and said, where are you getting these statistics about how much is designated in the city? Because I began using the statistic that 1.8% of the city was designated, or 2.1%, whatever it was at that time, which the statistic hadn't been used before. And I just said, well, I know the rate of designation and how much has been designated from these reports. And she said, can I have the material? And I said, no, because it's material that's executive material. It isn't publicly available, so I'm not allowed to give it to you. If you want to get the material, you have to go into the designation reports and do the count, which she then did. And her edition of Village Views in winter 1987, she published the results of that study, which is, the article was titled, Landmark Designation Finished? And she showed the statistical difference between the levels, the rate of designation in the, under the various chairpeople. And what also happened then was David Dunlap of the Times saw a pre-release version of this, and then on the day that her magazine came out, he wrote an article for in April 14th, 1987, titled City Landmarks Designation Slowed. It was on the front a page of the B section of the Times. And what all this did was applied great public pressure to the administration. So I don't know the facts of this. My guess is that when Gene was appointed, someone in the administration led him to understand that they weren't fully happy with designations continuing at the same rate, or they had some kind of negative feeling about it. And I think at a certain point, they reversed, and he no longer was under that pressure. And so he began allowing the staff to do the designation reports. And it may very well be that what caused this reversal from the part of in terms of the deputy mayors who were managing the Landmarks Commission was the article that was first published in Village Views and then in the New York Times, because it was so stark in showing the different rates of designation. So, but I think I said enough about this in any case.
Sure. Let me actually pause this for just a moment. So I'd like to focus now on some of LPC's more controversial decisions in the 1980s, to the extent that you can speak to those in your role as commissioner. I understand that there were preservationists who felt that the commission had not exercised its powers to prevent the demolition of several historic theaters in the theater district. What was your perception of the situation then, to the extent that you were involved, and what is your opinion today?
I can speak a little bit to this. The problem in designating the Broadway theaters was a problem that we saw with a number of building types, like movie houses, where if you lose the use of a building type like that, that is so specifically designed for that one use, that in a certain way you potentially lose the whole interior of the value of the designated interior. Because in my years on the commission, I saw a number of efforts to try to take old movie palaces and adapt them for other uses, as nightclubs, as shopping malls, offices. They all were abysmal because you couldn't efficiently fit these other uses in to a movie house without losing the rake of the audience seating area, and to some extent the relationship of the stage and its and the height of the stage to the audience area and balconies. And the configurations just are too specific for that use, and they don't lend themselves to these other things. So trying to reconfigure them for those other uses basically destroyed them in any case. What was left is little bits of decoration in these strange settings with chopped up spaces. So it was a disaster. So when it came to the Broadway theaters, we'd all had enough experience with movie houses. And another thing that's really hard to adaptively reuse is churches, houses of worship. As a commission, we had enough experience to know this was potentially disastrous in terms of saving the interiors of the buildings. But the issue became so much more complex because of the cultural and engineering attributes that were fused into these interiors as part of the design. So the buildings had this incredible acoustical properties, so that a performer could stand on stage and cast their voice to the whole house without electrified microphones, and could sing to the whole house. And that was true because the buildings were designed by theater designers who had gained enough experience in theater design that they could build interiors that had that kind of resonance. Part of it had to do with materiality. They were making walls in which they had horsehair mixed in with the plaster. Part of it had to do with configuration. They would put all those detailed moldings because it created multi-angular facets that would cause the sound to bounce in all kinds of directions. And many other things that I can't remember and probably never understood fully in any case, although I'd listened to all the hours of testimony of various people talking about this. So it was clear that the buildings themselves as theater spaces were this incredible resource because of their attributes, acoustical attributes for performance. And then, of course, they were singularly related to the cultural history of New York as the center of American theater. And with all of those great shows that were produced on Broadway, premiering in those buildings and running in them for all those years with all those great performers. So it was a very unique cultural condition. But then what added to the tension of the situation was not only were the buildings configured in such a way, you couldn't possibly adapt all of them for other uses. You know, you're just going to lose all these interiors. They're mm-hmm. going to look stupid while being chopped up. But they occupied some of the most valuable land in the city because they were in Midtown Manhattan. So, I don't think we could have designated the Broadway theaters if the mayor had not arrived. Mayor's office hadn't arrived at accommodation with the theater owners to create the special zoning that they did that allowed for air rights transfers, so that the air rights could be seen. The value of them could be seen by the theater owners. Part of this also had to do with the general change that was occurring in the economy of Broadway theater at the time, which continues to this day, which is that because of the union costs for all of the other disciplines and professions that go into mounting a Broadway show, the cost of doing a Broadway show at union scale in New York had gotten very prohibitive. And the theaters just weren't earning enough profits. It was too risky a thing to mount a show and put all the money into it, and then the amount you were earning against what the costs for running it were such that Broadway was suffering. So that all was part of the whole complication here, which had to be solved at some other level. And I don't know if it really has been solved, ultimately it's been partially solved. But the theater owners were clearly under stress. And so the city found a way to relieve some of that stress. And this idea of the air rights chancellor is something that had happened before in the history of New York City's designations. And one of the areas that is very similar, as the concept at least, is the designation of South Street Seaport, where several banks had bought some of those historic seaport buildings and blocks and as potential areas for development of office towers. And once the designation occurred, it became clear you couldn't have an office tower in on those blocks. And so there was an air rights transfer. The designation of South Street Seaport relied on the accommodation that was made through the mayor's office in regard to the air rights transfer. Because politically at that time, that was the only way to move forward. I think that was true with the Broadway theaters too, that the only way to move forward was if some kind of accommodation was made, and they made it for the air rights transfer. That allowed us to then begin designating things. Up until that point, until that accommodation was made, my memory is that the Broadway theater owners were being resistant to the designation, and at the designation hearings, they would be opposed. I remember this happens to be one of these things where there was a complaint generated against me. And I always found it one of the oddest complaints. We had a hearing on one of the theaters, and every theater designation hearing was marked by acousticians coming in and explaining the marvel of how these buildings managed to cast sound so well. And then there will almost always be some Broadway theater star who would come in. And we had many of these hearings in the theaters. And they would get on the stage and start casting their voice as a demonstration. These would be older time stars who weren't TV stars and movie stars, who were original Broadway theater stars who would learn to throw their voice that way. It was always the most marvelous thing because they would fill the whole space with a bit of "And You Get Your Gun" or Shakespeare. Mm-hmm. So I was quoted in an article in support of the designation of one or two buildings as saying these buildings are comparable to Stradivarius violins because they have an acoustical quality that we will never see the like of again. And I remember receiving a phone call from Gene saying the people at City Hall are concerned that you're being a bit too aggressive. And I thought it was so odd because all I was talking about was the acoustical qualities of the buildings and how remarkable they were. I guess maybe there was a miscommunication here, but that was the oddity of these communications coming from the mayor's office, that they were conveyed always secondhand. They weren't coming directly. Otherwise, the designation of the theaters, you know, obvious it was, how could you not designate them? But the truth of the matter is you can't save them unless you can save the theater industry. You have to save the use. Otherwise, the designations ultimately, in time as they played out, if you lost the Broadway theater and the viability of it economically, and those were no longer theater used as theater spaces, the designations would be rather meaningless.
So if we can move to St. Bart's, I understand that it was an important test for LPC, and I'm curious what the commission's prior positions were on dealing with religious properties and hardship applications and how they evolved as a result of the case.
Okay, the way you just phrased that has a kind of assumption in it, in terms of the commission existing as an entity that had attitudes and opinions, because the commission doesn't really ever exist that way. It exists as a group of one particular group of people, and that group is constantly changing with different staff members, mm-hmm. different chairs, and different commissioners. And the understanding that exists in that group only coalesces at moments of decision. So there isn't a general understanding that's moving along. There's the understanding that shows itself at the moment when decisions get made. In regard to hardships, there had been a whole history of court cases that had to do with the sufficiency of the commission's hardship findings. And the fact that the statutory finding that's written, is outlined in the Landmarks Law, does not adequately deal with buildings which were being used not-for-profit organizations. And so there began to be a second hardship finding that emerged, a required hardship finding for not-for-profit organizations, when not-for-profit organizations owned the buildings, that was mandated by the court. So by the time we got to St. Bart's, those of us who understood the Landmarks Law understood there were two rulings that would be involved, which is the statutory hardship test and the judicial test. But what we also understood was that the whole issue had become very inflammatory. And for Elliot and myself, I keep on going back to Elliot and I because we were talking all the time and because we were friends and we shared, Elliot served on the commission with me during the whole period of time I was on the commission. So we had shared conversations and attitudes about these things. During the time I was on the commission, there began to be formed organizations that were citywide organizations and ultimately, I think, nationwide organizations different religious groups in opposition to landmarks preservation. And there was one for the Catholic churches, one for the Episcopal churches, and I think there was one for synagogues, and then one for all religious groups together. And they would come in and testify against the designation of religious properties. And they also would come in and talk about, speak against the designation of religious properties in historic districts. So this all became a heightened issue. And it particularly became heightened when churches were in areas that had changed from their original residential use to some kind of business or commercial use, and where churches had lost the having a community, what do you call a group of people?
Congregation,
where the congregation lives in the immediate surrounding area, and because some churches like Trinity Church downtown, there's a congregation there, but it's coming from other places in the city to be at that church. So when the basic economics of a church, like with the Broadway theaters, began to falter because of the changing demographics of the cityscape, there were churches that just fell into a condition where they didn't have a large enough congregation and not enough money to maintain them. And that's, of course, a problem all across the United States and in all cities and in all historic districts. And we started encountering it as a practical matter. It was the same issue as the Broadway theaters and theater and the issue of the movie houses, which is these buildings just lose so much of their meaning as spaces if you don't have those uses going on in them, because they're designed so brilliantly and perfectly to fit those particular uses. And a church is designed for a congregation of people to worship God, and there's a kind of locus in the somewhere in the church, which is where everything comes together, where all the beliefs of the congregation come together, and then have some connection to vertically to the heavens. It goes up through the roof of the church, I think, right? And so it's all spatially designed that way, and it's beautiful. So St. Bart's was one of these cases, only it was the most unusual case because it had a very active congregation, It was one of the wealthiest congregations in the United States. It was one of the most high-powered congregations because it had lawyers and ex-government officials in the congregation on both sides of it, and because the parish was divided almost equally in half with people who were adamantly in favor of taking the offer to build a $100 million office tower over the community house, and people who were adamantly opposed to that. So I think it, you know, it's not, you're not likely to see this issue again. That combination of factors of it being in a location in Midtown, of it having such a huge congregation still intact, even though they weren't living as close to it as before, and to have a $100 million offer for this, for a piece of the plot to build an office tower. It has to be a church that has not only designated with the church, but has the adjoining property. So I think the issue of St. Bart's in regards to the commission's ruling is not a large conceptual issue. And by that I mean the law really prescribed proceeding in a certain kind of way. The first step was to rule if the applicants brought forward designs for an office structure, to rule on appropriateness. Right. And we saw two designs, and we ruled against them. And here I should say something about one of the phenomena of ruling on appropriateness, and that is, as I said earlier in this interview, one of the things you discover when you get on the Landmarks Commission is that you're looking at a cross-slice of the kind of design quality of new construction in the city as a whole. And I hope that's less true today. I hope that it seems to me that as I look at historic districts, if I look at everything that's been built in Soho or Greenwich Village over the past 30 or 40 years, the general quality of design of new construction in historic districts is far superior to the quality of design outside historic districts. I think that's through regulation, partly. But another part of it is that just as regulation exists as a reality in the social consciousness of the design community and the development community, it becomes more and more clear to the participants that you have to have better quality design if you want to get through the Landmarks Commission. And so I think the initial proposals that are brought forward to the Landmarks Commission probably represent an elevation in design quality that is accrued over 30 and 40 years of regulation. But back then, when I was a commissioner in the 1980s, design quality could often be abysmally low. And I think we saw abysmally low design quality more frequently than they do today. Maybe I'd be wrong about that. So here was one of the most difficult design problems you could possibly have in the cityscape. How do you design a high-rise tower to be in harmony or sympathetic relationship with a low-scale landmark like the Basilica of St. Bart's, and which has such high artistic value? What was so ironic about this situation was there was an example of how to do it right on site. It was the General Electric Building, which sat right behind St. Bartholomew's, which has a wonderfully sympathetic relationship to St. Bartholomew's because of the quality of craftsmanship, the color of materials, the fact that the materials are similar, they're masonry, it's orange colors and cream colors. And a number of architectural critics have written about the beauty of that relationship. So there was this living example of literally what to do at St. Bart's. You saw it. And partly the answer was that if you want to do a building that will be sympathetic with a beautiful low-scale landmark, design something of the same quality. The General Electric Building is another individual landmark of the city. And that's part of why it relates so well, because it is of the same quality level. But the designs that came forward to us were not anywhere near the quality level of the General Electric Building. we're not anywhere near the quality one would want to have an individual landmark, to meet the standards for designation as an individual landmark of the city. So that was the fundamental difficulty. They just didn't have good enough architects. And we saw that often at the Landmarks Commission, where major and very controversial issues would come forward, and the applicant just didn't have a good enough architect. And the commission doesn't control that. So they brought forward these two tower designs, and the architecture just was not anywhere near appropriate. And it wasn't going to be with those architects, because they didn't have, I shouldn't say it was impossible with those architects, but they certainly, the combination of the strictures of the developer mixed with the talent of the architects wasn't working out. And so I thought, though, as a matter of design review, those were pretty simple cases. The only thing that made them complex was the amount of money involved and the passions of everyone involved. The hardship ruling was a little bit more complex, not because it was unclear what the ruling should be, which was that they didn't have a hardship, that one of the wealthiest parishes in the United States did not have a hardship, was the conclusion. But what was complex about it was the technicality of actually working out the solution, which was analyzing all the data that was sent in. So basically what you're doing in a hardship ruling like this is the church sent in a body of material which showed how much it would cost to restore the community house and the church and the garden and keep them functioning at an adequate level so that their social programs could flourish, so they could fulfill their purposes and maybe even add to the space, and then show how much, and to show that that was a sum of money that was beyond a reasonable amount for them to raise. The standard for judging that under the statutory ruling was a certain fixed percentage, which was unrealistic. And it's a question that's raised about the statutory finding, that it has a fixed percentage. And one would think that it would be better if they would change that part of the landmarks law. And maybe they have, to make it a floating percentage having to do with changing economic times and the rate, return on loans and things of that nature. So, but that's just simple math. The other part of it is not so simple, which was judging whether St. Bartholomew's or a church like St. Bartholomew's had a certain kind of fundraising capacity. And then in between those two thresholds, the thing that made this all so complicated was that St. Bartholomew's sent us what I'm guessing was somewhere close to 6,000 pages
wow.
of material. And they had reports, like, you know, a 20-page report on their boiler, and how much it was going to cost to fix it, how it would only last for so many years, and then it wouldn't function properly anymore, and how much it would cost to replace it. And then they would have a report from a restoration firm for all the stone of the property, and how long it would last. It would erode due to airborne pollution, and how much it would cost to restore it. And so they had all of these reports, about 6,000 pages worth. And as it turned out, they were all overstated in terms of their cost. So how did we find that out? That was the headache. And we did an analysis of the report. And this was before the fight with Jean and over my reappointment, when we were working so closely together. Mm-hmm. And so I came in, and there had recently been a new executive director appointed, also a new head of the research department, and they didn't understand the hardship provisions, which are so very arcane. And I was the only commissioner who was interested in reading law. So Dorothy Minor had been giving me law cases for years, and I'd been reading them. So I understood the hardship stuff. So we finished with the hearings on, like, it was like a 60 or 90 day period. We finished on a Tuesday, let's say. And then the time was going to run out by the following Monday. And we only had that amount of time to analyze all this body of material. And we had to wait till the body was completely filled because the most current documents were updating earlier documents. So it didn't make sense to do the analysis that you had it all completed. And so there's a question of how we get that analysis done in the amount of time. And Dorothy had asked the church if they would give us a 15-day extension in order to do the analysis. And they said they would if we would keep the record open and they could submit new material on the record. So I remember I met with Jean and Dorothy and the heads of the commission on the evening of that ruling and of the last hearing, and knowing we had until Monday, which was 6 days or 5 days. And then they just said, what are we going to do? We can't do this analysis in that amount of time. But if we wait the 15 days, they'll add another 10,000 pages to the complexity. So I just said, we have to do the analysis now, because it's going to be the same problem. But we're going to have to wait till we get all the material, and then we're only going to have 5 or 6 days anyway. So Jean said, Jean had to undertake the rigor of knowing what was in every document in the 6,000 pages. So he had to read through everything and be able to recite that we'd looked at everything. He had to prove that we were doing due diligence. So that was all he was going to be able to do. So I came in and worked with the commission and the staff for all those days. And I met with the staff the next morning. We had a staff meeting. And Dorothy asked me to explain the law to them, because she said, you will explain it in English and not in legalese, and they'll all get it. So I explained the landmarks laws provisions, statutory and judicial. And then it was the most wonderful thing. I was there for the rest of the time, working from 9 to midnight for that whole period. The staff they're all so well educated. And they have, at that point, they probably had between them like 2 centuries of experience in landmarks preservation. And so they just organized themselves. We broke down the findings into specific sub-questions. So we were looking at maybe 15 or 20 questions that had to be answered. And they broke themselves down into groups to go through the body of material and analyze it. And with the idea that on Saturday and Sunday, they called up, there were 2 other commissioners who were architect members at that time, Francis Halben and David Todd. And Elliot, who was an architect member, couldn't rule on this because it had conflict of interest. So Francis and David came in to the commission on Sunday and met with the staff, and they tutored them on how to make parts of the finding. So they made parts of the finding and I made parts of the finding. But then the thing that was one of the most wonderful things I experienced at the Landmarks Commission was when we got to like Friday and Saturday, after the staff had kind of nailed down what the assertion was that in 5 documents about boilers, that they were actually finally saying this about the boiler or this about the stone restoration. Once they finally got it all nailed down, what they began to do was identify people throughout the city who were people who, professionals, whose practice was established best practice in their field. And they would identify people like them because they knew them, and would call, and they started calling out to them and taking the particular part of the analysis that they were involved with and getting their opinions about it and getting a counter judgment, a counter analysis. And I sort of grasp the wonder of this at the moment, but I grasp it more now in retrospect looking back at it, because I realized all these people were doing this analysis for free. They were doing it because they believed in it. But not only that, the staff were working unpaid. Because when we started this, the first thing I said to them on that morning of that first meeting on Wednesday or Thursday, as I said, I'm going to ask you to work from 9 to 12 all through the weekend on this. And I haven't made any arrangement for you to be paid. And there isn't any way to make an arrangement. This isn't in the city budget. You're not going to get paid for this. Mm-hmm. But I hope you'll all come in, because we have to get it done. And for the most part, I think they all did. We were completely staffed. Everyone was, so I, of course, was working for free. The other commissions were working for free, and the staff was working for free for large parts of the time. And they were reaching out to people across the cityscape who were, in a certain way, the accrued genius of the community in terms of knowledge about historic preservation. And it was all being applied to this evaluation on the basis that we all understood this was such an important ruling. And I think that was the wonder of St. Bart's, of that ruling, that we were able to tap into the genius of the city in making the best ruling we could. And eventually, you know, the Supreme Court did look at it and decided that there wasn't a case to be made. And so to that extent, they upheld the rigorous way we made the ruling. And I think that's the thing that is significant about St. Bart's. I don't know if it will all continue to hold up as law into the future.
What were the wider implications for preservation in New York City of that case?
Well, I think there were two large questions that were answered. One was that the commission could undertake the analysis of such a complex matter and do it within the time limits and do it in a way that, at least from the point of view of the courts, was rational and not arbitrary and capricious. So I think that was one thing. The other part of this is still not resolved, which is, can we save our religious properties? And I was at a colloquium last year and the year before last in Amsterdam, where one of the heads of UNESCO was there, and he started telling me about the hundreds and hundreds of churches in the next 10 or 20 years that were going to be desanctified across Europe because they'd lost their parishes. And various European governments didn't know what to do. How do you then preserve these buildings when there isn't a parish anymore? There isn't any money. And then how do you adapt the buildings for other uses because it's so hard to do so and maintain the integrity of the interior? So I think this is a problem across the world. And I don't think St. Bart's did anything to really solve that. It's a problem that still has its own momentum because of the social conditions.
Mm-hmm. Switching gears a bit, going back more to your personal story, did you remain involved in preservation after the Bryant Park controversy and your replacement? I understand, I saw that you had published a couple of editorials about the African burial ground in 1992.
Well, you know, I eventually went on and wrote a book.
Right. But specifically in New York City.
In the years right after. Yes, yeah. It did. But only on very specific issues. And one of the things that I became very interested in, because I was interested in it when I was a commissioner, was the question of the designation of African American heritage. And the two issues that came up were the Audubon Ballroom, where Malcolm X was assassinated, and also the African American burial ground. After I was replaced on the commission, I received phone calls from most of the newspapers in New York City, from the heads of their editorial page, asking me to write for them, and so I had access to those venues. The place I found to be very sympathetic was New York Newsday, which is a Long Island paper, which was then being published at a New York City edition, and actually had gotten to a point where its quality was such that one year it won more Pulitzer Prizes than the New York Times. So it was very good. And so I started writing a lot for them, a lot, you know, 7 or 8 pieces over mm-hmm. the years. And the thing that was so odd about both of those issues was they occurred during the mayoralty of David Dinkins. So he was the first African-American mayor of the city of New York. And he was one of the main obstacles to the designation of two highly significant landmarks in regard to African-American history in the United States. So that was a strange element. In terms of, in case of both of those issues, there were very prominent political leaders who were in support of the new development. And I believe the Dinkins administration did not want to cross and get involved in an adversarial relationship with them. In regard to the ballroom, it was Daniel Patrick Moynihan, who the United States Senator who had initiated, not the ballroom, with the burial ground. It was Daniel Patrick Moynihan who had been able to garner the monies to build this new courtroom facility in New York. And Daniel Patrick Moynihan was a very powerful man in the United States. So the Dinkins administration didn't want to cross swords with that. And in regard to the Audubon Ballroom, it was Charles Rangel, who had was getting money for Columbia University to build a new facility there that had to do with bio, new high-tech bio research. The ballroom was more complex because that was the only site they had. And I became interested in it and got in touch with the Kaplan Fund and asked if they would help me with this issue. And they were willing to give me some monetary aid to pay for an African-American historian to write a bit about this, and also to pay for some consultancies from a very skilled lawyer in New York City, Richard Emery, who is the lawyer who brought the case against the city of New York against the about the unconstitutionality of the Board of Estimate and brought the case to the Supreme Court and won that and changed the government of the city of New York. So he was adequately skilled for a landmarks matter. So we began to work with the new borough president, Ruth Messenger, to try to work out some kind of compromise. And the mayor was, the Landmarks Commission wasn't designating the Audubon Ballroom. They weren't moving to designate it. They weren't going to have a hearing. And it was getting closer and closer to the point where they were going to go into construction. And we just made as much of a fuss about it as we could. And eventually, people were embarrassed enough. Two prominent African-American politicians that they eventually took some kind of action and they set aside part of the ballroom. That was a less satisfying solution. The African-American burial ground was a different kind of case. So you know that they were doing test borings on the site and they went down to a certain depth. They started finding bone. And bone upon bone upon bone, layers of corpses. And they knew that this, they are archaeologists working for the Landmarks Commission, and I suppose for other organizations, but the Landmarks Commission had had archaeologists develop a kind of plan for lower Manhattan where they showed where there was a high possibility of finding meaningful archaeological material below ground so that the commission would be alerted to ask people who were doing new construction to do test borings. So this was one of those cases where they did these test borings and found this material. And then once they started excavating, it became this extraordinary story because although people knew there was a Negro's burial ground, it's called Negro's, spelled N-E-G-R-O-E-S in the old map. Mm-hmm. And that's the terminology I'm using. So people knew there was a Negro's burial ground down around there, but they didn't know exactly, you know, old maps are not that accurate in terms of measurement. So we didn't know if we on the edge of it or the heart of it or wherever it was, and nobody knew the density of bodies that were buried there. And it turned out, it would seem now in retrospect, we were in the heart of it, or at least one part of the heart of it, because there were so many bodies there. And so they kept on pulling them out, and then they developed a plan that they would send them to a university where they would be saved and then studied. And they started doing some of the studies pretty soon afterwards. And I think even while the excavations were still going on, and they said one of the things that the study showed was widespread malnutrition among all of the people who were buried there, that they really had, relative to other people from that period, mm-hmm. they had substantial marked malnutrition. So there were things that were associated with these scientific studies that obviously had meaning in terms of the social horrors of slavery. So there began to be political meetings about this. The commission refused to calendar a hearing on this, which was ridiculous, in my opinion, because this was the single most important urban graveyard from African American history in the United States, mm-hmm. which is simply that. And for the commission not to calendar a hearing was absolutely absurd. But they did it. And there came an evening where there was a town hall meeting, and I went to it just to listen. And the town hall meeting was hosted by the borough president's office, the Landmarks Commission, and several other representatives from other bureaucracies and elected officials. And what became pretty clear at that town hall meeting was the local government of the city of New York was not going to do anything about this. That all they were going to do was they'd reached an accommodation with the Department of General Services for the federal government to have a space in the new office building which would have a museum. And they weren't going to do anything else. But someone who was at the hearing from one of the groups pointed out a very simple thing, which is that the office tower portion of the new development would occupy about 70% of the site, and was 40 stories high, I would imagine. But then there was a low-scale pavilion that was only 2 stories high that was occupying the rest of the site. And whoever was representing this group just said, why build this pavilion? It isn't necessary. And why not leave, then, therefore, part of the burial ground as open ground? So I thought that was a very absolutely simple and clear logical solution to the matter. So I wrote an op-ed piece, and it got published in New York Newsday. And about 4 hours after the publication of that op-ed piece, the African-American Caucus of the United States Congress got together and threatened to block approval of the budget, federal budget, for all of the funds that would flow to this and to all other projects by the Department of General Services. And as a result, they had this property set aside by the federal government as a landmark site. I believe it was through them it got on the National Register. But there was immediate recognition that the construction of the Low Pavilion wouldn't occur. So it was Congress that saved this. After they'd already done that, they had a hearing at on Ellis Island, and the mayor was called to it. I didn't go to it. I've been told by people who went there that he was raked over the coals by African-American congressmen for not designating this. Sometime after that hearing, the Landmarks Commission finally acted, and they designated a landmark of the city of New York, which I'm glad they did, but they didn't have any hand in really saving it. The people who saved it was the African-American Caucus of the United States Congress. So those are the issues I got involved with.
Great. So I think I have a final question for you about the Landmarks Law and the Commission. Do you feel that the Commission's position and the law itself are stronger or weaker now than they were in the 1980s? And is the Commission still an effective steward of the city's landmarks?
I'm laughing at the needle-sharp focus of that question, which is somewhat broad, as broad as the curve of the earth. And I think these things are always relative to what is possible to do. And so we need to look at the law relative to what is possible and what is being done in other places. When the law was created here, and this is something I didn't learn until I researched my own book, but with that knowledge, I came to understand that when the law was created in New York, it had a very remarkable feature. It wasn't the first preservation law to be created in the industrial age. Those were created in France and Great Britain and Europe, and the earliest statutes were parts of government surveys that were occurring in the late 1800s. So we were 70 years behind. But what was remarkable about the statute was that it allowed a municipal authority to designate historic districts, and that those designations would be binding, that all of the new construction in those historic districts would require the approval of the Landmarks Commission with no level of review administratively. You could only go to courts. That is a very remarkable degree of authority to grant to a municipal branch of municipal government. And at the time when New York did this, Paris didn't have that authority. Nor did London. Nor did Amsterdam. As far as I know, the only place in the world where there was binding regulation of historic districts was in Poland. Because after World War II, after the German occupation had caused the destruction of so much of Poland's patrimony, they had very strong landmarks regulations created. So at the time when our law was created, it had, in terms of global, relative to other places globally, we were the first city to empower ourselves to designate whole historic districts and to regulate them. Which is why if one is going to study the long-term impact of regulation on a historic district, New York's one of the best places to do it because our historic districts are older. In terms of when they were designated and when they had binding regulation applied to them. In the other thing that was important about the New York law when it was first created is that it gave all the authority to one commission. So in Paris, for instance, there are national commissions that look over certain levels of landmarks. This is true in Rome also and all across Europe. And so there's national lists, and then sometimes there are regional landmark authorities, and then there's local landmark authorities. And so there's always a question of some degree of coordination between all these places. And the cities don't have full control over their own destinies. In New York, the city pretty much has control over its own destiny because no other authority in dealing with landmarks preservation has any kind of ability to regulate new construction, the things that are, except for the Parks Department, the National Parks Department. So that's also unusual that all the authority is vested in one place. And the difference that makes is that because we've done that, it makes it easier for citizens to understand what the policy is for the whole city, because you only go to one place. You go to the Landmarks Commission. Whatever their policy is, that's the policy for the city. And so you can then affect it. You can affect the policy. In Paris, it's harder because some of the policy is at a nationwide level and some of it at a local level, and you're fighting the president of France sometimes on some of these matters. So I think that's another attribute that is a strength of our law. And as compared to laws in the United States, by the year 2000, when I started looking at the number of laws that were binding in cities across the United States, I started looking at it as part of an inquiry for research I was doing on a potential new book. So I looked at it for 2 or 3 states. But in looking at New Jersey and at Florida, when speaking to the state's attorneys for both of those states, they both told me that the number of municipalities that had binding historic districts represented only 5% of the municipalities in each state. And from my experience in traveling around and lecturing in other places, I think that statistic is pretty consistent across the United States. So as a general notion, I would say, probably at this time, that no more than 10% of all of the landmarks laws in the United States are binding. So that's the other thing that's remarkable about New York's law, that it was binding in 1965. And although, for instance, Charleston passed its statute for the old and historic district of Charleston, I believe in 1931, but it could be 1933, it didn't become binding until 1968, 3 years after the creation of the New York City Landmarks Law. And I think that's true for New Orleans, too. Their law was not as binding as the New York City's law was. At that time. So that's the other thing, feature that's remarkable, that we had binding protection, not just of historic districts, but of, for all new construction. Now, if you look at the law today, what are we, 45, going on 50 years? I think the law is solid. It's a really good law. I think it's wise to have all of the authority vested in one agency so citizens can make that agency accountable for policy. It's a much better system than having a federal and a regional and a local authority. So I think that's better because you can make government answerable. But I think there's two things that I think are really missing ingredients to a more effective preservation policy in New York. One is simply this notion we have in the United States that property owners should pay for the restoration of their buildings without any help from the government. And I think that's an incorrect notion. And it's unjust. So one of the things I was surprised at was the level of subsidy for preservation in Europe. And during at certain for certain decades in the post-war development of Europe in Great Britain, Germany, Italy, France, the Netherlands, government subsidies for the restoration of historic properties reached up to 70% and 80% of the cost of restoration.
Wow.
Okay. So those governments understood that there was such a wide public benefit to be gained from this that there should be some kind of help given to private property owners. Also, the amount of tax relief for restoration work in Europe was much higher. So there was direct subsidies and much higher tax relief. I think it, at the very least in New York, we should have much better tax relief. Anyone who puts in money to restoring a private property that's part of a historic district or as an individual landmark should be able to write off all of that, all of the cost of the restoration against their city taxes. And I think that's just a basic kind of fairness that we need to eventually have for the city.
Mm-hmm.
The other things that is striking about New York City and also to some extent preservation in the United States is that we don't preserve historic structures as subsidized housing. And that is has become an important aspect of the demographics of many European cities, in that, for instance, in Amsterdam, in the center of Amsterdam, what is called Amsterdam Centrum, which is the area that was once enclosed by the last line of walls, in that historic zone, 30%, 35% of all of the residential structures are subsidized housing. And what that does is it ensures a diversity of people of different economic levels are living in the center of the city. And by securing that residential population, what you also secure is the availability of drugstores, shoe cobblers, grocery stores, and all of the features of residential life. And if you lose that population base and you start gentrifying and moving towards fewer and fewer people per building and also go to more offices and less residential, you start losing all the services that support residential life, and so you eventually get to a city, to districts that no longer are multi-use districts. They become districts that have mono economies. And I think that's very problematic in terms of historic preservation, and it's much better if we can keep mixed-use mixed-use districts, particularly with residential. So it would, the city would benefit greatly from an initiative that started to take historic properties and make them into subsidized housing. And it's something that's been happening in the centers of European cities, not a lot of them, but in some of them. And it's happening a little bit in the United States and other places. And the most notable place is Charleston, where their housing authority has won awards for its scattered site, Charleston single house housing, and also has won awards for the adaptive reuse of old institutional buildings as subsidized housing. And that housing authority has come to house, I believe, about 11% of the population of Charleston. In terms of the percentage of the population of a city that it serves, it may be the largest proportional housing authority in the United States. But what's interesting about the fabric of their holdings is that because Charleston has been a place that has regulated itself for its visual and historic beauty since 1931 or 33, they have a culture of looking at the quality of architecture. And the quality of the architecture that the housing authority builds and administers is remarkable. It's usually the best housing in an area, or some of the best housing in an area. And when you go into those neighborhoods, it's very difficult to figure out what the public housing is. You almost never can figure it out. There is no visible sign. Most of the time, you'd think that a Charleston Housing Authority project was either a really good new market rate building or a private institutional building, and it's neither. So I think that's one of the most important missing ingredients in having a better and more productive long-term preservation policy in New York.
Great. So that concludes our interview, part one.